On May 28, 1977, the Beverly Hills Supper Club in Southgate, Kentucky, was packed with patrons attending Memorial Day weekend private parties at the posh showplace, with another 1,300 people crammed into the cabaret room waiting to see singer John Davidson. At 9 p.m., busboy Walter Bailey interrupted the warm-up act on stage to announce there was a fire in the building and told everyone to leave. Not all made it out. 165 people died in one of the deadliest fires in U.S. history. In the next hour, we go inside the Beverly Hills Supper Club fire 40 years later. You'll hear some very graphic descriptions and accounts by former Beverly Hills employees Wayne Dammert and Ronna Shannon, patrons Kay Barksdale and Jeff Ruby, Southgate Fire Chief John Bates, reporters Nick Clooney, Norm Clark, and Jim Delaney, photographers Jerry Walter and Jeff Johnson, and Jim Teeter, part of the Teeter and McDonald warm-up act on the stage that night.
We were about halfway through our 30-minute show when I saw a busboy swiftly moving through the audience headed toward the stage. He came up with the four steps onto the stage and snatched the microphone out of Jim McDonald's hand. He turned and looked at the audience and said, "There's a fire in the building. You people need to get out of here. There's an exit door over there." Then he pointed, and there's an exit door over there, pointed over to his right, and then turned around and handed the microphone back to Jim McDonald.
My name is Nick Clooney. At the time of the Beverly Hills fire, I was the anchor of news on Channel 12 in Cincinnati, Ohio. This, as you know, happened on a weekend.
Nick, before we talk about the fire, I want to back up a little bit. I'm sure you were at the Beverly Hills Club a lot or some.
Many, many times, yes, of course.
And it was my recollection that many of the entertainers that would be on your show or on Bob Braun's show or on Ruth Lyons' show were entertainers who were in town playing the Beverly Hills.
You bet. And the Lookout House, those were major entertainment venues. When the big name people came, it was always over there at one of those major clubs. And Beverly Hills was the one that was the biggest of all and lasted longer than the others as well. And for us, it was very upscale. And it was renovated many times over the years, and it grew. And it had big showrooms where you could put, 1,000, 1,100 people in the room. And then there would be another room that would be a little bit smaller. And it would also be a showroom and a dining room. And then there would be the bar. When you first came in, there was an entertainment space there as well, a very large bar. And all of it was very ornate, very attractive, and quite well handled as an entertainment venue. You were always made to feel very special. A hangover from the days when there were very high rollers, when it was a gambling hall as well. And not too long before the era in which some parts of Beverly Hills, they still stored the wheels, the roulette wheels, and the gaming tables. Some of those were still in the basement.
My name is Wayne Dammert, and I'm 80 years old now. When I got out of the Navy in 1957, it was kind of tough getting a job. So I played golf at Summit Hills. So this day I played with three guys, and one of them was the big boss at the Beverly Hills. So halfway through our match, I said, "Mr. Todd, I wonder if I could get a job up there, busboy, whatever." He said, "Yeah." He says, "Be up there tonight and see Mr. Goodhart." And Mr. Goodhart was in charge of the gambling casino. So he put me on a dice table, and right next to me standing was Jerry Lewis. Right off the bat, Jerry Lewis, and he dropped about a quick $700. I'm dealing cards. I'm dealing the Stan Musial. It was really neat.
And then in 1961, it closed down. So it was empty till about 1970 when Richard Schilling told you he was going to buy it and remodel it
right, and
reopen it as the modern showplace that we knew it as in the 70s?
Yes, he did. It was absolutely beautiful. Mr. Schilling would go all over looking at things, construction sites, other buildings, other everything, to get the best. Chandeliers, they were tremendous. The walls were actually painted mural with rows are sticking out like a quarter of an inch, and it was just beautiful in there, everything the best. And he kept adding on, and he finally put the big showroom on there. But what happened right off the beginning was he wasn't using certain labor he should have been using, so Somehow, in 1971, it burned down. He didn't do anything for a week or two. He said, no, he's, what the heck, no, I'm going to go on with this. So he did, and it opened in 72.
And then the club grew and grew.
They built a new show room to hold about 700-800, and it became completely beautiful. It wasn't expensive at all. You got a meal and everything. To show you, 1 week, Frankie Valli was there. I think it was Saturday. His first show was on, and the line started forming by the entrance to the showroom and going back this long hall, 150 feet or whatever it was, and then that went up into a left turn up into the bar. Well, I looked, whoa, it's getting long. So it got into the bar, and these people were packed in the bar. I said, whoa, wait a minute. So I started the line back down toward the front door, down the steps, and I got to the front door. I said, whoa, nobody else is going in here. And they lined about 50 feet maybe down the driveway.
I'm Jeff Johnson. I was a commercial photographer, and I photographed most of the Beverly Hills Supper Club, probably late 1976, after my photography client, Harry Backus, had remodeled the place. I did not photograph the main performance room, but I did photograph the bar and the garden room and many of the other rooms after the remodeling had been done. So, well, Beverly Hills was very, very elegant, really. The designer had reworked most of the rooms, and he is well known for a number of the finer remodelings around Cincinnati in the 40s, 50s, 60s. He did the Terrace Plaza Hilton back when, and it was a classy style. He modeled his style to what you'd expect in a building, so it was classical. Now, Harry had put in various, like, wall coverings, vinyl and so on, and this was before there were regulations on that. So he got in trouble for these things that caused the vapors that killed people, but it wasn't his fault because this was before it was part of the code. And when I'm doing photography, you have lights. I never used strobe, they're just floodlights. So I needed electricity for that and ran a line down behind the bar into the basement. I went into the basement to hook it up, and here is one fixture in the middle of the ceiling with a number of wires stretched out from it with cube taps on it. And this is the basement of a place where hundreds of people are going to be. And I thought, well, this is not right. Also, that day that I was photographing, two different days, I was photographing the garden room, and I wanted to get outside to take pictures from the outside into the garden room. I couldn't find a way out of there. This is the daytime. Nobody's in the place except a few staff members. And I ended up in a closet full of chairs in the daytime with nobody else around. And my thought at the time was, this is a fire trap.
My name is Ronna Shannon, and I was a cocktail waitress at Beverly Hills Country Club in the cabaret room from late 76 into 77. As you walk in the door of Beverly Hills, you go to your right, and the dining room was to the left. You go down right down a hallway, and there were always people just packed, and we could barely walk through there. We had to hold our drink trays way up in the air to get through the people. The tables were 5 and 6 deep, where I had to pass drinks through the crowd for the people to get their drinks. I could not serve each table individually, and they were packed up against the stage, up against the exit door. I only remember one big exit, and it was closed. I mean, tables were packed up against it. I remember it being to the left of the stage. And there's no way people could get out even to go to the bathroom because they would push those tables all up against the people. It was really a bad scene. Every time there was a big show there, which was about every weekend, you couldn't walk in there, and it was hard to get a drink order. People were just packed in there like sardines. And we had to wear white go-go boots and white short shorts. And we had to walk on greasy floors. And I fell one time because there was so much grease on the kitchen floor and my drinks and tips went everywhere. People were practically stepping on top of me then because it was such a mad rush. And Richard Schilling was so unsympathetic and told me, like, just get up and get busy. I was brushing off my bruised knees.
This is Jeff Ruby, and I'm in the restaurant business. And I was in Beverly Hills with my girlfriend, two other couples, and I was a regional director for Holiday Inns at the time. One of my managers says his girlfriend was her 21st birthday, and he wanted to take her to Beverly Hills. And another couple, was our wine distributor and his girlfriend. And I didn't really want to go because John Davidson wasn't an act I was interested in. And I was there actually for the opening day of Beverly Hills, and Frank Sinatra Jr. opened the club. So it turned out I was there for the opening and the closing. The Shillings were friends of mine. And so we went because I could get us in and I could get us good seats, which turned out to be a problem because we were front row center stage. And the problem with that was that was as far away from the exit as you could be. They had some ventriloquists as a warm-up act, an opening act for John Davidson.
I'm Jim Teeter. I was one half of a comedy team called Teeter and McDonald. My partner was Jim McDonald. This was the third engagement, 10-day engagement. We were there first with Nancy Wilson, and then we were there with Vicky Carr, and then last with John Davidson as the opening act. We did about a 30-minute show in front of these people to open their show. We were about halfway through our 30-minute show when I saw a busboy swiftly moving through the audience headed toward the stage. He came up with four steps onto the stage and snatched the microphone out of Jim McDonald's hand. He turned and looked at the audience and said, "There's a fire in the building. You people need to get out of here. There's an exit door over there." Then he pointed, and there's an exit door over there, pointed over to his right, and then turned around and handed the microphone back to Jim McDonald.
My name is Dr. K. Francis Barksdale. I was hired at WCPO-TV as the secretary to Mr. Mort Waters, who was the chairman of the board at Scripps Howard. And I am a member, and I still am, of the Greater Cincinnati Core Union. That is a gospel group. And we were going to have a get-together for the Memorial Day weekend, and we wanted to go to a nice place. It was a spectacular, fantastic place to go.
So that night, you're in the Crystal Room upstairs. Mm-hmm. There's about 100, 120 of you, do you think?
Well, this is what had happened. When we got there, I saw Charlene Matthews and Lenore Hill. They were the ones who were in charge. And so they were seemingly to be upset. And I said, "What's the matter?" And they said, "We were told that it only would hold 75 people in the Crystal Room." They had sold over 100 and some tickets. So I saw them bring out more tables. And about the time when we were supposed to have been served, we were not. And we wondered why. And the tables were bumper to bumper, table to table, because they were round tables. And the waiters and waitresses were standing there whispering to one another. But I found out later that the fire had already started downstairs and the people were getting out, but they had not told us that the place was on fire.
Comedian Jim Teeter in the Cabaret Room.
We were up on a 4-foot stage, so we were pretty safe. We were not in the middle of the people. But this young man just yelled fire in the middle of 1,100 people. Now, let me point out something right here, John. I do not in any way think this boy did not do a heroic thing. I mean, if he had not have warned us of this fire, hundreds of people would have been killed. At no point did the people think this was part of the show. I mean, the lights came on in the room. The spotlight went off. The stage lights went off. The people got up and started moving immediately. So they didn't think it was part of the act. It was for real. And then I noticed that a cloud of smoke roll in the entranceway, and it was white. It looked like a cloud. And I knew at that point it was not a fire in the kitchen. So I dropped the microphone down to my side, and I looked at Jim McDonald, and I said, "Jim, let's get out of here." We put the mics back in the stands. We exited stage left into our dressing room. On the way, I picked up two ventriloquist dummies that I used in the show. Jim picked up his banjo and a third dummy. We exited through our dressing room into another dressing room that was attached to ours, and that was the musician's dressing room. Then we made a left turn into a hallway, and this hallway was completely full of black smoke. The people from the audience were in this hallway exiting to an outside door. The club had been built onto, so exits didn't lead to exits. They led to other exits. The fire, too, was smoldering. You could see it on the walls as we exited down this hallway. People were starting to panic at this point. They were yelling, come on, go, go, move. And they were pushing, and it was getting kind of bad. Well, when we got to the outside door, it led down a hillside. There were about 10 steps going down the outside of the building. When I got to the bottom of these steps, I wheeled around to see if Jim McDonald got out, and he was just coming through the exit door. He came down the steps. When he got to the bottom, fire sealed the door over, and nobody else came out. But I didn't have anybody that was real, real close to die in the fire. But John Davidson did. He had a music director, Doug Hara. Doug Hara, instead of exiting the room, went up on the stage and started collecting the music at the music stands. And he never got out. So John was very emotionally involved and doesn't really like to talk about it because it brings back a lot of terrible memories.
Jeff Ruby in the cabaret room.
This kid comes on stage, busboy, and makes an announcement like a trained professional that's been in the business for 30 years and has dealt with this before, that there's a fire. Stay calm. It's nothing, you know, just want to make sure and ask you to please go this way, go that way. And I couldn't believe, you know, in retrospect, after, you know, everything that happened, being in the business myself, how do you hire this kid? Which I knew later I did hire because, you know, I knew he needed a job and he saved my life. But I took my drink with me. I didn't think we were in danger. But if I'm going outside May 28th, I'm going to be thirsty. So I brought Jack along with me, my friend Jack Daniels. And we start to go up on the stage, and then another busboy says, you can't go this way. So we start going another way. And my manager says, Jeff, I'll never get out this way. And that was to our left, facing the stage, it would be to our left. And there was not a line. That was just a mass of people trying to get out one exit, I suppose. Now we were last in that mass. Because we had hesitated, we were going over the stage. So now we go to the other way. And I see Scott Schilling running for his life, covering his face. I just said, you know, this thing is serious now, I think. And busboy says, you can't go this way. And I said, F you, or whatever I said. And then we're starting to make it through a line of people that were in front of us and people behind us and going through a dark hallway. Now it was serious. I no longer have the Jack Daniels with me. In fact, he was the last person I needed at that time. And they start pushing. And I turned around and I said, everybody stop pushing. If we're going to get out of here alive, we're going to have to stay calm and not panic. And if you push, we're all going to die. So they listened to me. And the smoke was choking me. You know, it just gets in your throat. And the greatest sight, John, to this day in my life was seeing outdoors. Somebody had gotten the door open. Where you could see on Alexandria Pike where that sign, the Beverly Hills, the showplace of the nation. Well, when that door opened, and I'm down the hall, I saw daylight. I saw an opening through that dark cloud of smoke. I saw that daylight. I saw that outdoor Alexandria Pike, that grass out there. I saw freedom, you know, freedom. You know, I'm going to make it. People behind me didn't make it, a lot of them.
Kay Barksdale in the Crystal Room upstairs.
Before they served us the meal, I noticed that it was getting hot in the room. The butter on the butter plates were melting, and the iced tea with the ice in the glass started to melt. And the time that we were waiting to be served, all of the ice had melted. So when we saw that the smoke had started coming into our room, we were wondering, what's going on? Where does that smoke? Where is that coming from? So I got up to go. And at that time, someone hollered, oh, don't worry about it. It's okay. It's only a cigarette. And the waitresses and waiters were still standing there talking as if they wanted to tell us, but they had been told not to tell us because they didn't want to have us in a panic state. So all of a sudden, we saw the smoke getting darker and was bellowing in to our room. And I got up to leave. And by the time we got out there in the hallway, oh, it was filled totally with black smoke. So the people from the Afghan room, they were running down the hall because they were trying to find out what was going on. And they had not been told that the place was on fire. But then someone shouted out, "Get out, get out. This place is on fire, get out." And that's when people started jumping up from their tables and they were knocking the tables over, trying to get out of the room. And when we got out in the hallway, the smoke was so thick. We were trying to run down the corridor, but there were so many people out there in the hallway. We couldn't see. And I remember going to my left of the crystal room down the hallway. And I remember trying to see, and there was a lady that was running in front of me. I don't know whether she stumbled to fall or she was knocked down, but I just know that she fell, and she was trying to get up, and she was screaming, "Help me, help me, somebody help me." I heard somebody say, "Help yourself, we're trying to get out of here too." I never did see that lady get up, because she was down and people were running and trampling over her. And when the smoke came up from the stairwell, it hit me like someone had thrown soot into my face. And at that time, a woman grabbed hold of my arm and grabbed me and held me and turned me around and told me to follow her. And I went back from whence I had come, down the hallway to the wall, pressing my way back into the room that I had come out of, called the crystal room. I remember that I had left my purse, and I went over to the table to get my purse. And I had put my purse under my arm, and the smoke was in the room, and it was so thick that you couldn't hardly see anything. And by this time, there was a man. The woman had grabbed my arm and brought me into the room. There was this man standing there in a beautiful light blue suit that I've never seen blue like that man had on. He had pure white hair. And yes, he was a white man. I saw the face. He was telling me, "Follow me. I'll show you how to get out." I believe this with all my heart, and I'll always say this until I die. Don't ever believe that God cannot make a doorway out of no way, because I had to testify for 14 lawyers. I told them about that, and they said, "Miss Barksdale, there's no way that you could have had a doorway to come behind the wet bar that we had in the crystal room." I went behind the bar. The door was there. I remember looking to the left of me, and there were people trying to get out of the room. They were trying to find any way out that they could. And the people were pulling on the door, and they could not get out because that doorway had a chain lock on it. Well, I found out later, if they had gotten out, they probably would have died in that fire anyway, because that was only leading up to the roof of the building. But the doorway where the man was leading me, there were other people in the corridor coming down the corridor. And I remember seeing it was wood paneling down the hallway, and the people were walking real fast trying to get out. I remember we got to the end of the hallway, and there was a makeshift stairwell that they had put up. It was to have the waiters and waitresses to bring the food up from the kitchen area, so it would save them time from coming all the way around from the front of the building. There was a light over the stairwell hanging from a light cord. I remember going down the steps, going through the swinging door of that hallway, and I entered into the kitchen. And to the right, I remember seeing it really was a fire in that building, bellowing in from the area of the first floor, because we were now on the first floor. The fire was bellowing in from the doorway, coming up to the ceiling and climbing the ceiling and going across the wall. There was a man. This was a black man telling me to come this way. I remember going behind the stove. The pots were on the stove. This man had on all white, and he had on a chef's hat. Smoke was coming into the kitchen area, and the people were screaming, and the people were running in different directions. And I followed him when we were at the dock area. So I couldn't get out that way. So I had to come back from the dock area and go where the man was leading me. Some smoke hit me into my face. I came out and I saw my choir members out there on the lawn, and they were all crying.
Of your group, did everybody make it out alive?
All of them made it out alive except two, Lenora Hill and Charlene Matthews. They were the two that were in charge of our being there for that night.
Banquet Captain Wayne Dammert.
This was getting almost to nine, close to nine by that time. So I went in and opened the back doors to the crystal rooms, and Fran Oakes was standing there. I says, "Wayne, there's a fire down in the zebra room." I'm thinking, "Wayne, it's just there." And I looked, and I saw some smoke come up that long hallway that's upstairs. So I put that Sal down fast, and I said, "Out the back, everybody out the back, as loud as I could, get out the back." And boy, they all turned. They all went back, and then I went through them down to the other end to make sure everybody's out. And when I got there, there was a black man from the party across the hall, and I said, "Get out of here, man." And he turned, and he flew out. His eyes got like great big marbles, and he flew out of there, and I don't blame him. So everybody's out of that side, so I know 27 people had been using the dressing rooms on the other side. So I went back to the back near where the door was, and it was all clear out by then. And I went down the other side, and there were like 12 10-top tables in there, and that made it room crowded. And I got through there, and I got the doors at the far end. I was going to see if I could get over there and help anybody that might be in there. I eased the doors open about 4 inches maybe wide. And it was so hot that you couldn't believe it. So I went back there, and I got in that back hallway, which is an L, just a little old service hallway. Wasn't nothing to it. And in that hallway was a plywood door, just because it was for maintenance and stuff, that went out onto a flat roof. It was a nice, cool, pretty night outside. Well, I get in there, nobody's moving. It's jammed. And I yelled to just a couple of these big guys, I said, "Knock that door down." And Miss Schilling later asked me, "Why'd you say to do that?" "I wanted to get out of there." But it did have a padlock thing on it. They tried twice, and it didn't break, and the lights went out. Pitch black. I know this thing is roaring toward us. There's no question about it. And I saw a complete color picture of my family in front of me. That was the good Lord telling me, "You need to get out of here." So I worked over to the wall where the doorway and where the stairs and the elevator were. Unfortunately, nobody could get on that elevator because it was locked. I worked my way over, we can get out of here. Well, when I got to the stairs, people started moving. I got down there, went through the kitchen. The kitchen was well lit, and the kitchen help was on the tables trying to direct people, but there wasn't hardly anybody left at that time. Then the Empire Room was empty, so I think I got to get and see if those people got out. So I went out the back little service platform. I ran around to the front. There was a couple fire trucks there already. And I asked the one guy, I said, "I need help." He said, "No." He said, "The chief's got us going around the back. I don't know what's happening in the back. I know what's where I was." And I helped a fireman get an axe and a ladder. And I said, "Well, I need to have people trapped upstairs." So we put that on the front of the building, the left side of that. And I went up first, and I helped pull him over that. He's got all the equipment on everything. We got to that door. He put his axe in there, and that thing just come right open because one more hit was open. And all this thick black wall of smoke just came out on us. Scott Schilling was with us there too. Well, Scott and I just, we went back down. There's nothing we could do. So then I went onto the veranda, And there was a beautiful young lady, probably maybe about 30 years old, laying on the ground there. Her husband, I guess, is with her, and she has a heart problem. The first life squad then just pulled up. So several of us picked her up and carried her over and put her in the life squad. And they says, "That's all we have room for. We got to go." I says, "No, you're not going anywhere. To see if anybody else here, I don't know." And that's when they bought Paul Smith. He was a violinist in the show because he had his tux on and his show stuff. So they slid him in the floor. Then there was no way for him to turn around or anything. I put my hand on his door handle, and I says, "I'm telling police, fireman, ever get out of the way, because we're backing this thing down." And another life squad squeezed past us going up. And when I came back up, I did the same thing to him. I walked two of them down.